Blog Talk Radio.
Returning to your roots, discovering what works best, trying new things, and then going back again to what works best. Today on the show, I'm bringing back Play Better Today, but instead of featuring that first, we will hear it after the interview. I think that's going to work better for people. Also, we're going to add another brief segment called What They Say and Why Does It Hurt? So that's a little mystery for you. Today our guest, Julio Goudreau, is one of the very best tennis coaches in the Southern Section. He's very highly rated with the USPTA, PTR, and is a USTA high-performance coach, as well as deeply involved with 10 and under tennis. Very influential in his area there. So we're going to bring him on the show in a moment. And I just wanted to remind you that we're doing a little bit of life coaching here on the show sometimes, and Julio's going to bring some life coaching of his own. So here we go. We're going to get him on here. Hello, Julio. Are you there?
I'm here, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing great. How's everything in Mississippi right now?
Everything is great. As you would imagine, Christmas shopping, but aside from that craziness, everything else is calm.
Okay, awesome. All right, so let's talk about you and how you grew up and learned how to play tennis yourself.
I'm from Puerto Rico. Grew up in Puerto Rico and pretty much self-taught. It's back to that philosophy that the USTA is trying to bring around now where it was based on the amount of sets that we played a week. Everything was pretty much figured out on your own as you were playing. You would do something, try something, and you did it yourself. Not too many lessons, not too much organized, but as you know, the world has changed and everything now is organized and has to be programmed into kids and player schedules.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, it's funny, not too long ago I had Ross Case, former Grand Slam doubles champion, at my club. And I was asking him about how did he learn to play tennis. And he said, yeah, just about everybody was self-taught in Australia. And then people just compared notes with one another. So, you know, you're like, hey, how do you hold that forehand? And then, yeah, then they would try it out. So I think there's so much truth to that in terms of experimentation. But, you know, obviously then sometimes people pick up bad habits. So who was it who helped you to get your good habit?
What helped me get my good habits?
Yeah,
that's a very good, deep question. Very goal-oriented, very driven. I can't tell you that it was maybe, if I was to think about it, maybe my dad. Reflecting on how we got up every day and he left the house to go to work and came back from work and was sometimes doing multiple jobs instead of just one. There was always a reason to get up in the morning and go do something. So there was no staying inside the house, no staying around, no laying around. And of course, we didn't have computers and we didn't have video games like we do now. So it was always looking for something to do outside. And I played just about every sport that you could think of, and I was a pretty decent athlete, so I got to play it all of them. I was not on the bench. But what I liked about tennis was the fact that I control my own destiny. I didn't have to count on the other guys to be able to be playing well for us to have a good game. So I did play the other sports in, during the season, but tennis pulled me because of how individual it was. I had complete control of what was happening on the court. I tell you the truth and be sincere with you, I didn't really like doubles until I was forced to play it in college. Up until college, I didn't even like to share the court with somebody else. I just wanted all the responsibility.
Yeah, I can relate to that. And then, yeah, it's funny. Ironically, I really hated doubles for a long, long time. And then once I became a pretty good doubles player, then I got labeled as a doubles specialist, which I hate that. I hate that. I'm like, I was a pretty good singles player, you know? I mean, but I just happen to be better at doubles now, whatever, you know? Okay, so what was kind of, how did you get to the, you went and played college tennis, and where did you do that?
I went to Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And I had a friend of mine that was playing baseball and going there, and as a result of that, found myself going to Duquesne, and it was a great experience. Pittsburgh turned out to be a great city to go to college at because of how it's set up with University of Pittsburgh, Duquesne, and there's about three or four other small colleges within a certain perimeter. So your social life, it's very diverse. It's a lot greater than just the 8,000 or 9,000 students that Duquesne had to offer. But it was a great experience. I mean, tennis has been a great tool. I have no complaints. It's I have an MBA. I'm fully bilingual. I'm capable of sitting in front of multiple people and speaking and presenting and engaging a crowd. And I could be doing a million things, but I teach tennis because I truly love the game. This quest of being as good as I can be as a former player now has transferred into trying to be as good as I can be as a coach. And now it's starting to transfer into what I'm feeling. It's a calling to share with other coaches, to become an educator, not just to the students that I get to work with, but with fellow coaches and sharing with them a lot of my deep knowledge, almost like my secrets, things that I figured out that work for me. I'm at a point where I'm starting to try to just share it with them.
Yeah, that's a great thing, and that's certainly part of the mix of the ingredients of what it's going to take, you know, for tennis to continue to grow and for U.S. tennis to get back to it. So if more people were really doing that kind of stuff, that would really help. What was the transition from your junior period of time into Duquesne? Was that a D1 school?
It is a D1 school. It's in the what's called the Atlantic 10 Conference.
Okay.
So schools that you might have heard of that you would know, aside from Duquesne or Duke Wesley, you have Temple. It's in that conference.
Okay.
St. Joe, UMass, Rhode Island. So there's quite a bit of schools in the conference. West Virginia University used to be in that conference also. We had some pretty bad beatings by guys named Joby Foley and Paul Mancini. It was not fun.
So your college coach, what would you say that you learned the most from your college coach?
Goodness, I'll say respect and endurance. I have a very good relationship. My college coach, we got a very good relationship now. While I was playing for him, it was a battle. I don't know how the man put up with me. I mean, I was extremely stubborn, and I thought I knew it all. And I was I'd either play one or play two. I didn't play anything lower than two on the team. So, I was very, very difficult to deal with as a young man. And I thank him every day because he put up with me. I'm not sure that I would have put up with me if I was him, but for some reason he did. And I guess endurance, he endured me and put up with me and gave me a big compliment. When I went to graduate, he came to graduation and he said to me, thank you. And that surprised me because I was expecting, the last thing I was expecting was for him to actually show up to the graduation or to actually say thank you, because I thought I'd been so difficult to him. And I said, thank you for what? And he said, you were the one player that I had on the team that I knew you'd go home every summer, and when you came back, you'd come back and you'd be in better shape and playing better than you had left. That was never a concern. Your work ethic was just second to none.
Yeah, well, that's tremendous, and I think that shows that coach, you know, had some patience, which that's such a great trait to realize that, you know, sometimes there might be some stuff that rubs you the wrong way, but ultimately, you know, you're looking at the end product of what happens after the 4 years. So that's terrific, and it sounds like it really left an impression on you as well. So that's stuff to carry with you for sure. You know, it's funny, this is off topic, but I have to say that one of my favorite TV shows of all time was set in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, called The Guardian. You ever see that show?
No.
It's a fascinating show. The thing I love about that show is it's Simon Baker, who's now known as The Mentalist, and he plays a lawyer in Pittsburgh, and that's the only show I've ever seen that captures inner city life authentically. I've never seen a TV show that was so real when it came to that stuff. So let's get off that, but people can get on their Netflix and go look up The Guardian. I thought it was awesome. Anyway, so now that you've been coaching for quite a while, what are some of the fun stories that have come out of your life as a coach?
Fun stories as a coach.
Crazy.
It's funny because when I think of fun, I think of wins. And you ask that question, it triggers into a lot of thoughts of when we work with parents and we try to advise parents that we tell parents to not get caught up on the wins. But immediately when you ask me what was fun, fun was working with a player named Kristen Roth and getting her to quarterfinals main draw at Eddie Herr, quarterfinals main draw Orange Bowl, semifinals at all the Super Nationals that year, and being 2 points away from being the number one player in the country and finishing five in the country that year. And it's funny how I find myself thinking like a parent and reacting how we often hear parents talk, and we go, no, we don't want you thinking that way. But that's what came as fun immediately, and then I had to think, I had to reflect. Wow.
Okay.
What else?
All right.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun, coaching that player to achieve that success. And if I was to think now of what turns out to be fun now, it's the fact that creating an environment for young people to come be in, to train on a daily basis, that they feel it's safe, that they feel it's trusting, that they can trust the people that they're around, and that they don't feel that they're just a number, but that they actually matter and mean something to the people that are working with them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the daily grind of keeping it, but not letting it be such a grind, and keeping it fun kind of every day that you go out there to do the work. So who have been some influential coaches that have kind of influenced your coaching style?
That's a very good question, because years ago I started in the industry, and I was being successful as a coach, but I didn't know why. I could not put my finger on why what I was doing was working, and I had grown a little bit of almost tired with the tennis industry. I was thinking about going out and doing something else and not staying in tennis. And along came the opportunity to do the USTA High Performance class. And when they brought me into that class, it was Dr. Paul Lubbers was the one that was running the program, but he had brought in someone from England to kind of help with the program, or maybe kind of, I'm not sure, they were trying to define what role she was going to play in the whole thing in regards to American tennis and development in the future. And her name was Ann Pankhurst. And Ann was my savior. Ann gave me all the reasons. When I left that program, I understood the connection between biology, physics, and geometry, and what it was, the role that it played, and why what I was doing was right, and why what I saw others doing was not necessarily the right way of doing it. And she saved me. I mean, I stayed in tennis because I got exposed to Ann Pankhurst. If it was not for Ann, I probably would be doing something else right now.
Okay, so if you had to say, you know, what's one principle that you picked up from Ann, what would that be?
The fact that not all players are the same, the fact that you have to take biology into account and that every human being is different from they have a different physical predisposition of how they will have to play based on what their body types are and what they're physically like. And there's also an influence of the emotional, the psychic, that I may have a player that's, an example, we look on tour and you see Monfils, and Monfils looks like a physical specimen, a beast. Someone that should be playing probably very tight to the baseline, taking the ball on the rise, coming in, huge serve. But when you watch him play, it's a complete opposite. He stays back. It's a retriever, just defending and running. And what it tells me is my old Julio would have said, this guy's completely wrong. And no, this guy is just it's a physical specimen that has a physical attributes to play a certain way that emotionally it's not capable of playing that way because that's not how his mind is set up. It's not how he's instinctively will react and will make decisions in very small time frames when a ball's coming at him, what he instinctively will do. So what you see, it's what he actually makes sense to him from a psychological standpoint is how he plays. But unfortunately, he's just almost trapped in a body that doesn't match what he's actually doing.
That's a great point. And, you know, I think that exactly right there is why a lot of academies go wrong, because they get out their big cookie cutter, you know, and they try to put their stamp on players and they try to make everyone play a certain way. But great coaches, you know, work with everything that the player has to offer. And you know, the physicality and the mentality and the where their personality is right now, and discovers, can they change mentally? Can they become more aggressive or not? You know, and if not, then you work with what you work with. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I was talking to Alistair McCall, and he was talking about Bernard Tomic, and you know, Tomic is kind of similar. It's like, why does he play so far back? But that's what he's comfortable with. And if you're going to take someone radically out of their comfort zone from their personality, then they're going to struggle with confidence, right?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and they'll start making – you'll start seeing some real bad decision-making.
Yeah, so it's about discovering everything that your player can do, you know. Here's an interesting thought. I have this guy who's kind of a mentor of mine, and he was talking about how there's a myth of personality that people presume that the way they are now is permanent. So to what extent do you try to help people branch out? How do you help people branch out into like a new level of either aggressiveness or conservative play?
Well, any time that we live in this world and we have issues or we have any problems as a human being, the first step to it, it has to be brought up to your attention. You have to realize that you had that problem. So sometimes we encounter players that we feel need to transform or transcend or grow into. And the way that I do it is I start bringing in a very passive way. I start making them aware of how they are, who they are, what they do, and what the future is, and get them come up with their we interact with regards to what it is that they perceive themselves to be in a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years from now. What do they perceive this final product is going to be like? What are they going to be like? What would they like to be by the time that they're in this? I'm going to use a specific case that I'm working with right now. I'm working with a young lady that's a very good player, a very, very successful player who's actually in her second year in college. And when we're working now, everything is not towards the now. It's towards where you're going to be in 2 years from now. What is it that you want to be accomplishing on that last and final year, on your senior year? It's not so much what you're doing right now. Right now, we're just in the process of getting there, because your college career may be it. It may not. In this case, I hope it's not. I think she's got an amazing first step foot speed and athleticism that's a world-class level that she selects to continue with it. But if she selects to not continue with it, that will be the end when that college career comes to an end. So why think and get so obsessed with your sophomore year when your senior year is the one that's going to be the ending point, the final period on the book? Pay attention to it. Let's work towards what is it that you want to be when you get, where would you want to be when we get there? When you look back at your body of work, what would you want to see that you had accomplished? If you were number one in the country right now as a sophomore, great, amazing, unbelievable, good for you. But then where do we go from there? There's nothing left. You already reached the peak of the mountain. Are we going to leave college now and go play pros because that will be the next step? Or are you ready to do that? No, you're not ready to do that. You don't even not sure if you want to play pros right now. That's what you verbalized back to me. So why are you in such a hurry to be at the peak of the mountain? Let's enjoy the journey. Let's enjoy where you are right now.
Yeah, that's great. And it's a different perspective than I've heard before, because and I think there's a lot of wisdom there. So you're causing me to really think. So, plan for the ultimate. Where is it going to end? And so I guess the wisdom of that is then it helps them to maximize it, whatever it is.
It helps them. Well, they'll verbalize to me. They'll hear themselves say what it is that they're trying to accomplish, what they want the end to be.
Yeah.
And verbalizing and hear themselves say it, then it makes a much easier transition for them to agree that maybe I need to start taking that ball on the rise. After they hit two or three consecutive balls back cross court, I feel like it's a high risk, but I need to. And after I take that ball on the rise, I do need to maybe look to sneak in and come in and close out the court, although I'm not comfortable with that, because that's where I need to be. That's what the top, the better, the ones that are right now where I'm trying to achieve and get to be, that's what they seem to be doing. And it makes it much easier for them to answer your question earlier of being able to almost reinvent themselves and evolve and transform into a growth process instead of being just stuck where they are and just always being that way.
Yeah, that's interesting. I always reflect on this one particular match. It was Jennifer Capriati versus Megan Shaughnessy, and Shaughnessy had worked herself into being a more powerful player. But she'd always kind of gone back to being conservative when things got tight. So they're playing this great match, and they're just blasting the ball all over the court. It gets to be 3-all in the third set. Capriati keeps blasting. Shaughnessy kind of shrinks back, and it was 6-3. I mean, from 3-all, it was 6-3 in about 4 minutes, you know, And the announcer said something very cagey, you know, that when it gets down to the brass knuckles towards the very end, you're going to go to your comfort zone. So training people well enough that they can have that comfort zone to be able to do that thing in the crucial part of the match when it really matters, that's magic. So it kind of sounds like that you're talking about building them up to the point where they have extreme confidence to do that at the ultimate moment.
Yes, because they as you and I know, that, I mean, it's independent decision making, and they have to recognize it and they have to execute it. Like, nobody does it but them.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. Okay, so let's shift gears here. All right, what do you wish that you had, what do you wish you'd known at the beginning of your career that you know now?
What would I wish I would have known at the beginning of my career that I know now? That I guess that parents are not the enemy. That we have to find a way to work and communicate with parents, that they often live very unhappy lives, feeling that their kids are unfulfilled potential. Because they have, wow, they have very, in this, it's unfortunate, and I can only relate to the U.S. I cannot relate to the entire world, but what I perceive in the U.S. and the country that I've worked with players, it's left up to the parent to be the expert, to select the team, to select the coach, to select everything, but they have very little knowledge to be the expert. But they feel that responsibility, and they have to fulfill that role as a parent. And often they get caught up thinking that their kid is going to be it, and they overlook the development of a human being, the fact that when you look at the spectrum of someone's life, tennis was just a contributing factor. They don't have the experiences that we have as coaches. I mean, I can tell you I'm a 1970, so I'm from that with that era of Agassi, Sampras, Chang, Courier. And along with those names, there's a bunch of names that in the juniors were very successful, but then they didn't materialize. You have, I mean, Ty Tucker, now coaching Ohio, was a great, it was just at that level with those guys when we were juniors. But it just, and Martin Blackman was amazing. And it just did not, these are names that the common parent will not have heard of. They won't know them.
Right.
And they don't realize that I show up today every day to work and make my players get to be as good as they can possibly be. But whether they make it or don't make it, and the ones that do make it, I do believe that it's almost out of our hands. It's not that we plan it. For everyone that makes it, there were thousands and thousands that should have. And for everyone that doesn't, there's thousands and thousands that shouldn't have either. I can't put my finger. There's no magic potion. I wish that I would have known earlier to embrace the parent, to feel a little bit of almost compassion, to help them understand and be more of a communication tool, to have known as much as I know now, so now I can educate parents instead of just fighting with them. Because in my earlier stage, I was very divisive. You drop your kid and you leave. You don't stay here. Don't give me your input. I don't want it. I don't want to talk to you. I coach the player. I don't coach you. Early on, I was like that, and now I've transformed into this integration. And this past year, I ran an experiment where I went really deep into trying to integrate the parent, and I don't think it worked. So I'm playing with this integration of the parent, and I'm trying to find a balance. I think too much integration then sends them out with a responsibility to come back after a tournament and tell me what the secret is. And you and I know that one tournament, it's not going to make or break the secret. So I'm working on it, trying to find a way to integrate the parents and integrate them in a more positive way so it's a more enjoyable experience, this whole tennis development thing, instead of being one that they constantly feel that their kid is underachieving. And I mean, I have one now that we just transitioned from 10s to 12s, and he was extremely dominant in 10s. I mean, he went an entire year in 10 and under where he dropped.
I'm sorry. I have to do a little something. There's a little bit less than a minute left on the live feed, but then we're going to be going to podcast in about 45 seconds. So I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I like your thought there, and so if you can pick that back up again. So you were talking about the parent integration.
Yes. Do you want me to continue now, or
Yeah. Well, actually, let me. Well, now that I wrecked it, sorry about that. Let me interject now that I screwed that up. Yeah. It's funny. I never really thought I was gonna be like a. I never thought I would be a professional radio guy, and it turns out to be true. I'm not really a professional. So, but it's still fun. I think people have a fun time listening as I screw up every week, you know. But, okay, now back to the serious stuff. You know, it's funny. I've experimented with democracy, you know, at different times in my programs. And, you know, it almost never works. So what I'll do every once in a while is maybe I'll have a little democratic moment. And, you know, I'll say, all right, kids, you know, we're going to take a break from totalitarian dictatorship here, and I'm going to let you choose the next drill. And you should see the shocked looks on the kids' faces, and they like it. And they also like it that I'm in nearly complete control. That gives them security. And so, yeah, I agree with you that there needs to be a balance of you know, people voicing their opinion and being heard, but that the coach really does need to be in control of the program. Because when that control is lost, then you don't really have a, you know, the clear vision of the program kind of goes with it. Does that kind of capture what you're saying, or am I a little off?
No, you're right on. You're right on. It has to be. You are there to direct. You are there to guide. You are there to give feedback. You are the expert, and often the lines get blended, and parents stop seeing you as the expert, and that's when you have to, in a very passive way, I guess, go. You know, it's funny. This whole thing has connected itself, because what I'm describing now is probably what I made my college coach feel, what I feel now with parents. The kids achieve success, but it's amazing how hard we work to get to one goal. We can work for years to achieve one goal, and when that goal is met, how the celebration and the enjoyment and the relaxation of meeting the goal only lasts like 5 minutes, and immediately there's a new goal in front of you. And how obsessive the pursuit of that new goal becomes. And as a result, the kids really, it's hard to get the parent to understand your kid itself can't play when they feel that you want it more than they want it themselves. They feel the pressure. And when I talk to parents and I tell them, I say, look, you're not getting it. I know that you think you're saying all the right things, but you're completely unaware that only about 7% of the communication that happens between you and your child is actually verbal. There's about 93% that it's all cues and things that your gestures and things that you're doing and things that you're moving, and how your eyebrows lift or your eyebrows drop and how they perceive and they read all that communication that you're giving. But you're completely, how it's amazing how we can live, and we have this world and this culture that we live in, and how little, how unaware and poorly geared parents are towards understanding their kids, understanding the development of their kids, the stages of development, the fact that, yes, until a girl's about 14 or 15, she's going to be a complete pleaser. She'll fight you over what flavor of ice cream she's going to eat, but she wants to know that when she goes to home, at nighttime when she goes to bed, that you still love her and you approve everything that she did that day. Well, I got news for you. By the time she turns about 15 or 16, she ain't going to care about whether you're happy or unhappy when she goes to bed. It's a matter of whether she's happy with herself. And that's what we... That's when if you keep on putting your finger and your hand on this girl now, and you don't give her some freedom, and this tennis thing doesn't evolve to be where it's her tennis, when she's 15, 16, she's going to tell you she's done. And all this time that you put into it, and all this false feeling of control that you think you have over your kid being a tennis player, it's out the window, because she's not going to play anymore. She'll quit tennis. She doesn't care anymore that you like it.
Yeah, no, that's great. Let's back up for a second, because what you said about the nonverbal communication, I had Vic Braden on the show, and one thing people don't know about Vic is he's involved in some pretty crazy stuff. So he helped develop facial recognition software that is used at airports for early detection of possible terrorist threats.
That's amazing.
Vic Braden's just crazy amazing, right? Well, anyway, so they took the software and they used it on parents at junior tournaments. And so the parents, some of the parents were looking like terrorists.
Yeah.
And then they used it on Roger Federer while he was playing Rafael Nadal on clay. And then they used it on Federer when he's playing at Wimbledon. And they said that the psychological factors behind the way Federer looks when he's playing Nadal on clay are just, he just looks like a completely depressed human being. So,
yeah,
facial recognition software. So, so there's so much truth to that. And so what do you advise parents to do? I mean, I think sometimes you can just change the look on your face and then you can change your feelings by doing that. But what if parents don't want to go through that? What do you advise them to do if their nonverbal is so bad?
Believe it or not, actually, sometimes I've done some role play with them. And I've asked one parent to videotape the other one as they're watching a match so they can, because often they're completely unaware. They don't get it. They don't see it. If it's an older player, let's say it's a player that's maybe 14, 15 years old, I will create a situation where I become a bit of a mediator. I talked to the player first, and I said, I know that you're not enjoying the way that your dad is sitting on the sideline and how your dad is watching the match. I know that it's not an enjoyable experience for you as you're playing the match. I said, how would you feel if I bring the two of you and I bring it up to try to fix the situation, not to create a problem, but to try to communicate so your dad, it becomes aware that you're uncomfortable with how they're acting. And I can remember one particular case where the kid said, yeah, let's go for it. And I brought the dad in, and I started off the meeting by bringing to everyone's attention how much love I knew that there was in that room and how much I knew the father cared for the son and how good of a father he was because he provided and he seeked better things and improvement for the kid. And then once I kind of butter him up and I had him feeling really good about himself, I said, are you aware that your kid is uncomfortable by how you're behaving on the sidelines? And he looked at me and all confused and dumbfounded. He said, I mean, no, what are you talking about? I said, well, I watched this one match and I know that there's, and I immediately identified that he was uncomfortable by your behavior based on the body language that I was reading from him on the court as he's playing the match. And the fact that every time he made a mistake, you got up and put your hands on your head and you paced from one side to the other. And whenever he won a shot, then you clapped like a crazy maniac. You are a roller coaster of emotions that every match your kid plays, you either live on a high or a low, but there's no constant. There's no middle. And then I brought to his attention these points, and he looked at the kid, and he said, is that true? And then the kid said, yeah, I kind of feel that way. And he looked at the kid and said, I'm so sorry, son. I was completely unaware. I didn't know that I was making you feel that way. So you have to find a way in which you can become a bit of a mediator, not just a tennis coach. And you're looking for the well-being of a human being, not just how good of a tennis player they can be, because there is a connection between a successful human being and a successful tennis player due to how independent they have to be on the course or playing a match and how all the decision-making is made by themselves.
Wow. Yeah, that's a great story. And, you know, I think you know, what you've already done, you've already answered the question, what advice would you give to coaches? Because I think the answer here is to follow your example. And principle is, and that's just to really pay attention to what's happening. And then, you know, I think also, you know, you've also kind of answered the question of what advice would you give to parents? And that would be, you know, to realize what kind of effect you really have on your kids. You know, I know as a parent, I've had to deal with that, you know, and it's not always easy when you get the realization that sometimes you don't give off the same thing you think you're giving off.
You know,
in terms of attention and support. So, you know, that's some pretty keen advice. We have about 10 minutes left. Yeah,
Bill, there's one thing I realized maybe about 7 years ago, and it is that parents are completely unaware that kids are different than they are. They all assume that their kid will think and behave. They think that the kid is the same. If they're a type A, they assume the kid's a type A, and if the kid is not behaving like they would in that situation, they immediately go to conclusion that that is wrong. So we have to become very educated as coaches so we can improve players, but at the same time we can be almost like beings of helping people live happier and better lives because of how isolated this tennis game is and how unhappy life can become if parents and kids do not understand their roles in this whole process.
Right. No, that's great. And so, you know, I think let's shift gears here because I think also I know for certain that you're a great example of the kind of thing that you would like to see parents and kids partake in because you and I had a coaching conversation, you know. And, you know, so I thought it was great when when we talked about, some stuff. So what was that? What did you like the most about our coaching conversation?
I think it's priceless. I mean, it was the ability for me to share with someone who's in the tennis industry, who understands tennis and understands what I'm going through, and get a sound opinion of whether this is good or this is bad or this is the right direction. I'm not sure that people are aware of the service that you provide, and I think it's one that they need to be very aware of because it was probably the best money that I've spent in the last 5 or 6 years. The fact that I could call you seriously, I'm not trying to make you feel amazing, but it was good. It was a very healthy experience for me to talk with you for that 1 hour and get your feedback on, I think this will be your perspective on a different angle of how it works. So often we're caught up in what I call the tornado. We live our lives and our lives become very busy, and it's almost like we're in the center of the tornado, so we don't know which way the tornado is going so we can avoid it or get out of it. And we find ourselves continuing to be in it. And to do it, it was good because you see my life and I present to you my life and you're looking at it from outside the tornado and you help me give me direction so I can actually get out of the path of the tornado.
Okay, so you weren't trying to make me feel good, but it worked anyway. And you know what's funny? I would say that I was trying really hard not to give advice, but simply to just help draw out your thinking better. Because in the coaching conversation, it's not about me at all. It's about the person that I'm talking to. So, you know, it's basically asking questions. And then I thought the great moment was when you said, you had your aha moment, and you were like, that's it, right? And then you came up with that, and that's the same kind of effect that we want our players to have and our parents to have. We want them to want to draw them out so they can go, that's it, you know, and then everybody's blessed that way. So, yeah, I mean, it's something that I would like to do more to help everybody in the tennis world, you know. So I think it's...
If you're a tennis pro and you're listening to the show, and you are at what you feel might be a crossroad in your tennis career, you're frustrated with something that's going in particular, pick up the phone and call Bill. He will really help you. I'm not kidding. I'm not just trying to sell you, Bill, but I mean, I got over 25 years of experience. I've been to the point that I've become so frustrated with the experience that I'm having on the court with players and parents that I've gone to see a therapist to get advice on how can I handle this better? How could I become a better coach? How can I become a better communicator with tennis parents? And my experience with you was probably the most valuable out of any of those experiences that I've seek to have self-growth and direction and kind of get over certain frustrations that I was feeling.
That's great. That makes me feel, it does make me feel good to know that level of service was given, because I do want to serve people properly. Let's now go to a different topic. We have about 5 minutes left, and then we want to wrap up within about 5 minutes. But let's say there's some players out there, like USTA players and captains and whatnot, and you know, either they don't practice enough or they're never going to practice, but what's a way that they can improve kind of on a daily basis? What would be one thing that they could take out on the court today? Let's say they're listening to this in the morning and they're going to go out on the court. And so what's one little nugget that they can take with them on court to play a little bit better today?
Tennis has to be played in a realistic, not in an idealistic way. So we're all dreamers, and we dream and envision ourselves doing things often beyond our capabilities at the current moment. When you're playing tennis, you're playing a sport that you're going to win or lose based on errors, not winners. So technically, the person who's successful that day on the match, it's not the one who was the most successful. It's the one who found the way to be the least of a failure. So find a way in which you recognize where your white and your black are, where you're doing too little and where you're doing too much, and there's a bunch of shades of gray in between. Those shades of gray is where you're supposed to be playing. You're not supposed to be at the either extreme. You don't want to be holding back. You don't want to be doing more than you can. One thing that I tell my players, and it's big in my philosophy, is every ball you hit, you have to be responsible for the ending. So you hit a ball on your side of the net, but that ball has to be hit with the purpose of where it's going to end on the other side, not with a simple purpose to see where it ends, but a way in which you know where it's going to end. So you have to construct shots with the outcome in mind, not with the shot itself in mind. It would be like if I want you to come visit me in Madison, Mississippi, I tell you where I want you to go. I give you my address. I don't tell you to come to Madison, Mississippi and find me.
They do that
so
in
when you when you hit a tennis ball, you need to hit a tennis ball with the specific, with your objective, your end result, where you have to have in mind where you want to go. If your example, if you were to be driving the car, well, do you get in the car and think of where you want to go, or do you get in the car and think about how to steer and how to hit the gas and how to hit the brake? You drive the car based on where you're trying to accomplish and you want to go to. Well,
yeah.
You cannot – the mechanics of how to hit a ball, how the racket goes back, what you're doing in the present moment on your side of the court, it's like thinking about how to steer, how to hit the gas, how to hit the brake. Well, what you're going to do on your side of the court – has to take in consideration what you're trying to accomplish on the other side of the court. So we don't play really on our side. We develop skills on our side, but when we go to compete with those skills that we develop, we play on the opposite side of the net. We don't play on our side of the net.
That's terrific. So you know what's great is that what you just said right there fits really well with what I'm going to say when I get to my Play Better Today segment. So that's awesome. Now, so if you had to sum up this conversation and people were going to take away, you know, one, two, or three things, how would you sum up this conversation in three main points maximum?
Point number one, educate yourself. If you're a tennis pro and you're listening, if you're a player or a parent, educate yourself. There's not enough knowledge in our lifetime. We don't get to live enough to gain all of it. Keep your eyes open because you can learn from anybody and everyone. There's always something to be learned. And be patient with yourself, your student, your kid, your dad. It is a process. Things evolve and erupt because there's a lack of communication and people live too much on assumptions. So always talk and don't assume that people are understanding or people know what you mean by things. Ask them, what do you think I meant by this? What do you think this means? What does this mean to you? Because you'll be surprised that it tends to mean something completely different to them than what it does to you.
Wow. All right. And so that's a wrap. So, hey, Julio, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really enjoyed talking with you, and it was a really fun conversation. So I hope that lots of people get to hear this one. And anyway, so have a great day, and thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate it. You do the same. Take care, my friend.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye. So, wow. So it's really interesting to me how these conversations, we always start with very stock questions, and then the answers are just amazing. So Julio definitely is bringing a very unique perspective there, and one that I'm definitely going to ponder. I think I say that almost every week. So now it's time for time to talk about the life coaching a little bit. I do life coaching to tennis coaches and parents of players, as well as musicians and other creative folks. So here's my offer. You are invited, the listener, to partake in a free two-hour coaching conversation with me. All right. So the only thing is that's subject to availability, so hopefully we can make that work. It's a standing offer. And subject to availability, you can have a two-hour conversation, and there will be no high-pressure sales pitch, nor is it two straight hours of advice giving. You know, we collaboratively draw out your best. And so you kind of heard Julio talking about that a little bit. I thought that was really nice that he had such a great experience. All right, so we're going to go on now to your best tennis today, all right, because playing better today is partly a matter of removing anything that's not part of your best performance. Mentally and emotionally, I see how people start beating themselves up on the court. And sometimes they do it when they're not even warmed up. So, you know, don't decide early that it's going to be a bad day on the court. Get yourself into the match. Go play better today. Be aware of how you're feeling. If you feel frustrated about a shot after the point, stop and let that frustration go and come back to only the ball. Repeating that mantra of only the ball, only the ball, is a great way to keep your mind engaged with the only thing that really matters. The ball is the only thing that matters. Your opponent's over there. The ball's over here. And like Julio said, you want to take the ball and you want to play it intentionally to a place on the other side. So, we're going to get into another thing in a moment, which is what they say and how it hurts, which also relates. But you playing the ball is the most important thing. If you kind of remove the emotionally draining trap of frustration and step back, and come back to focusing only on the ball, then you're going to do better. All right. The final segment here is what they say and how it hurts. People say, be more consistent. I need to be more consistent. You need to be more consistent. And what they generally mean is never miss a shot. And so that's where Julio would say, that's too conservative. You know, that's not intentional enough. You haven't decided where you're driving your car to, right? I've never, ever heard anyone say, I was really happy with my consistency today. So people use it to beat themselves up. And then you get the frustration, okay? The trouble with consistency is that it doesn't really win too many matches at the 4 or 5 level or above. You know, rather it's the calculated risk of taking your shots, knowing what you want to do with the ball. And then you're going to roll the dice a little bit, and you're going to be happy with a 70% win percentage. You're winning 70% of the points when you take a certain shot. You will control that match, right? So know what tactics you're going to use. Go in with the idea of controlled aggression. Controlled aggression is that middle point. Back to what Julio said too, you know, because you have the aggression, but it's not unbridled. And you have the control, but it's not completely unaggressive. You're going to a place where you're going to win the point instead of try really hard not to lose the point. Because many times you try not to lose the point, then you become unaggressive, and then the other player can take control of the point and beat you. Right. So it's important also to realize that if you don't have to miss a shot, if there's no good reason to miss a shot, then don't miss that shot. Right? But continue playing fearlessly, keeping the ball deep, and then attacking short balls and being creative with that short ball. And, you know, take a lesson. Learn new ways to attack a short ball that lands over here and one that lands in the middle and one that lands over there. You know, one that's floating and one that's coming a little bit lower. So, you know, work on these little pieces of your offensive game and you're going to do a lot better. But first, free your mind from the foolish consistency, which is the hobgoblin of shallow mind along those lines. All right, have a great day. And remember, you can find me at infinitecoach.org, or you can email me at infinitecoach.org@gmail.com, infinitecoach.org@gmail.com, which, you know, is kind of tricky because it's got the left side in there. All right. So now, as is my custom, I will leave you with this.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.